2018 was a significant year for Smart Talk. It marked the 10th anniversary of the show's debut in 2008. It also was the second full year of Smart Talk road trips to interesting locations around Pennsylvania. On today's installment of the top stories of 2018 on Smart Talk, we look back at and highlight several of the Smart Talk road trip conversations. Last February, we traveled to the Senator John Hines History Center in Pittsburgh, where we discussed the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. On February 19, 1968, 50 years ago, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood premiered on PBS. It was a different kind of TV show for children, and it was made that way by Fred Rogers. Fred Rogers was a soft-spoken and gentle man who didn't speak down to children. While kids were entertained, they also were learning valuable life lessons from Mr. Rogers. Smart Talk is marking the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood with a road trip to the Senator John Hines History Center in Pittsburgh. There's an exhibit here with many of the familiar set pieces that make everyone from generations feel part of the neighborhood. In the first part of today's program, we'll be speaking with Deborah Ackland, President and CEO of WQED Multimedia. Ms. Ackland, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
Also joining us is Paul Sifkin, President of the Fred Rogers Company. Mr. Sifkin, welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott.
The 50th anniversary, obviously it's a milestone anniversary, but as we pass that February 19th milestone, the exact date when the show premiered, it was just unbelievable how many media, how many people across the country marked the occasion. It showed just how beloved Mr. Rogers and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was. Paul, what did you think as you saw all this attention coming from across the country?
Well, I think it's a testament to how personal Fred made his appearance on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, so that there were generations of viewers who saw him as speaking directly to them, and he spoke about topics that were important to children, ideas. He acknowledged that sometimes children have angry feelings or might be worried about some things that are happening in their lives, and gave children an appreciation for that, and also sort of the ability to accept that it's okay to have those feelings. That spoke so strongly to children that I think as adults, when they look back on the program and they look back at Fred, they have very, very strong personal attachments to him.
And that was unique. Not only did Fred Rogers have a unique delivery, a unique way of presenting himself on the air, on the program, but that one-on-one, being able to connect with children, how was he able to do that?
Well, I think as he described it, he used to just imagine that he was talking to one child sitting there in their living room, and treated it as a conversation, a one-on-one conversation. And that was a really amazing skill. When you look at it from a production point of view, from a performance point of view, it's not easy to have that personal connection with the viewer. But he did that, and I think that's part of the reason why people remember him so fondly.
Something else that was striking is that, as I said, he had a unique delivery. He was unique on camera. But many children's programs, there were kids in the audience. There was a clown. There was a mascot, those kind of things. Now, there were characters on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. But Fred Rogers was the real deal. He was genuine. From what I understand, the person you saw on the program, that was Fred Rogers.
Yes, and I think part of the reason that he made Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was in response to what he was seeing on television, in response to hosts who were standing up and being clowns and there to entertain children rather than to engage them. And he took what he did very seriously and worked very hard at his craft to make sure that the messages he was giving were meaningful to children, and he respected his audience, and that was something that I think then and now stands out, particularly for children's entertainment. Unfortunately, I think in the entertainment world, children's entertainment was sort of late to the game of producers realizing that you need to respect your audience and present content at the level that they can understand it and that they can appreciate it. And Fred understood that very early on, and it was important.
February 19th, 1968. When you say 1968 to many people today, the first thing they think of is 50 years ago, what this country was like, Vietnam, civil rights era. There was a lot of chaos going on. There was a lot of violence. Not exactly the kind of era that you picture someone like Fred Rogers coming on the air and talking to children. But as you said, he talked about some of the issues that kids were hearing about, maybe not dealing with, but hearing about around them. How important was that in that era?
Well, that is something that I've heard a lot about from people who were working on the program and who were watching at that time, was that Fred was giving permission for children to have feelings other than, happy feelings all the time. Television didn't have to be all about laughs and jokes and pies in the face. He was acknowledging that we live in a world and that sometimes this world isn't perfect. And we're going to acknowledge for children that he understood that and that he was listening to the issues that were going on in the day.
Deborah Acklin, you are the president and CEO of WQED Multimedia here in Pittsburgh. The program premiered on PBS in 1968. So WQED's role in starting the Mr. Rogers Show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Well, I'll tell you, Scott, I think that WQED and Fred Rogers are absolutely intertwined from day one.
I've always thought of that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually the true story. It's very much our origin story at WQED is the Fred Rogers story. So as I understand it, and these are things that were told to me, is that Fred was our very first program director. So some of you may know that WQED is the first and still the first community-owned public television station in the country, and really was the first. So there were a handful of stations in the country. They were going to start a station in Pittsburgh, came up with the great name of WQED, and Mr. Rogers, at that point Fred Rogers, as I understand it, was working at NBC in New York and decided to come back to his hometown, his home region. He was born in La Trobe, and start along with this startup television station. So he was literally deciding what went on the air the first few months, and then the woman who ran the station, and yes, in 1954 it was a woman who was the station manager, pulled him and a woman who was a performer at the Pittsburgh Playhouse and put them together because she needed a children's program that could be expandable. It could go to fill whatever time block they needed to fill. And they put them together. Josie Carey was a great singer. Fred was a musician and had other skills. And so they put it together into a program called Children's Corner. In Children's Corner, the early days, you can see the neighborhood start to evolve and start to emerge. So Fred was there from the beginning. And, of course, then in 1968, really put WQED on a national map 14 years after it began.
So when he started, now again, this is handed down to you, but what was his thinking, what was his vision of what kind of children's program did he want?
I don't know that I can answer that question except to tell you what I have observed and what I've been given to understand, which is that I'll tell you a great story, which may not exactly answer your question, but it does start to put some of the pieces in place, if that's okay. My understanding is that the night before our station went on the air, which the night before was March 31st, 1954, Mrs. Daniel, who was the name of the station manager, held a party for the people who were going to put the television station on the air the next day. She gave out party favors. The party favor she gave to Fred Rogers was a hand puppet of a tiger. He named the tiger Daniel in honor of Mrs. Daniel. And Daniel then later became an absolute star. He's a star to this day. My understanding, again, is that as they were trying to figure out how to fill the time of this live television, he and Josie, that someone cut a hole through a mat. Fred put the puppet through, and he said something like, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, something like that. And Daniel was born. And then the story was that the stage folks would paint something on the flat. One day there was a clock, one day there was an Eiffel Tower, and so on. And all of those, of course, became the iconic images from the neighborhood. I think it was later that he saw this potential of television and, my understanding, his own ministry in order to create a program that really did then become Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and was singular in its effect.
Well, if we've gotten nothing else out of this program today, we learned about Daniel Tiger. That is amazing. I've never heard that story before.
So when you see Daniel Tiger on PBS today, that is a legacy all the way back to Pittsburgh, 1954, and the origin of WQED.
Started the night before the TV station went on the air.
That's right.
Well, Paul, that brings up a point. The Fred Rogers Company is commemorating, with a lot of other people, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the start of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and Daniel plays a big part in that. Talk about what the company has in mind for this year.
So Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood is currently one of the top performing series for PBS Kids, and is the animated version of the Neighborhood of Make-Believe. And we thought, what a wonderful way to pay tribute to the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers would be to connect episodes of Daniel Tiger that we've created that are based on previous episodes of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And so next week on PBS stations nationwide, including WQED, PBS will be running a Daniel Tiger episode followed by the Mr. Rogers episode that inspired it. And we're hoping that that will be a wonderful opportunity for children to be introduced to Mr. Rogers, but also a co-viewing opportunity for parents to sit down with children and not only sort of share those stories and those lessons together, but also share some of their own history, because so many parents grew up with Mr. Rogers and they're very proud to now be raising their children on Daniel Tiger. So that's the role that Daniel Tiger is playing in the Mr. Rogers celebration. We have other things going on as well. March 6th, there is going to be a primetime special that is celebrating 50 years of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. That's hosted by Michael Keaton, who many people don't know, started his career at WQED.
That's right.
Working as a stagehand, I believe, on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And that also features a number of celebrities who are looking back at the great moments in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Some of those include John Lithgow, Esperanza Spalding, Sarah Silverman. So some voices that you might not expect to see, but also people like Yo-Yo Ma and Itzhak Perlman will be reflecting on not only the show, but their appearance on the show. And we're excited to offer that up to stations and to their viewers to look back, with adult eyes on the program that really was so formative for children's television in the last 50 years.
Let me ask you this question. Just what you were talking about, when you look at the program with adult eyes now you're much closer than most people, but what do you see? What do you see today that maybe you didn't as a younger person?
For me, again, with my eyes working in television, I'm really impressed with the choices that Fred made. He was very intentional about how the show was produced. The scripting was so precise. He made sure that every word that came out of his mouth was vetted by his mentor, Margaret McFarlane, to make sure that he was not only telling a story, but he was saying it in an age-appropriate way, in a way that was in line with proper child development techniques. So I look at that and look at the hard work that went into creating the program, and I'm very impressed by that. At the same time, I think it was an amazing improvisational show. Deb was talking about sort of from the very beginning, there was improvisation in terms of naming characters and coming up with set pieces. And those characters and those set pieces just sort of naturally flowed into the program. Very improvisational, but also the music on the show was live. That wasn't added later. That was right there on the show, just a remarkable combination of preparation and attention to detail on the front end, but then being willing to be completely improvisational in the process is an amazing thing to watch.
When you talk about everything, when the script is thought of how children will be impacted by it or what children will think about it, having some thought behind everything, I think one of the greatest stories that I've heard about Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood is just the beginning and the end of the program. The idea behind walking in the front door, taking the jacket off that he wore during the day at work, we all assumed, putting on the cardigan sweater, changing into comfortable shoes. Why is that important?
Well, anybody who works with young children knows that routine is important. That helps children to understand a very confusing world when you're a young child. So that format of having a routine every day where Mr. Rogers came in the door, he welcomed us, and at the end he left, was very helpful for children to understand this is the end of my television visit with Mr. Rogers. And one of the things that Fred believed was that the important thing after the visit was that children might turn that show off and then think about what they saw on the show in their real lives. He wasn't encouraging them to, you know, continue to watch the very next episode. There was no binge watching then. In fact, he was very happy to say goodbye at the end of it, and then children could walk away. So that was very important in terms of that formatting and that routine that he wanted to introduce to children.
And the cardigan sweaters made by his mother.
Yes. Again, that goes to sort of the, it's not the improvisational nature of the show, but sort of the homegrown nature of that show that while it was very, very meticulously made, it was also somehow at the same time thrown together. It was a really terrific combination, a very unique program.
Paul mentioned Michael Keaton. And I had a number of people say, oh, you have to ask about Michael Keaton. I mean, yes. he went on to become a big movie star. Mm-hmm. Talk about a young Michael Keaton's role in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Well, my understanding is it was sort of like the circus. You know, you had all of these characters coming together, and you know, you were talking about 1968. So when you look back at some of the pictures of the stagehands were long-haired dudes, you know, who looked like the times in many ways. And so those are some of the pictures of Michael Keaton as well. And my understanding is that he was quite a prankster on the set.
I could see that.
Yeah. And there was something that they did, a little bit of an obscure part of the neighborhood, was something called the Flying Zucchinis. And the Flying Zucchinis were sort of a faux circus act, I guess, in many ways. And definitely meant to be ridiculous and hilarious. And so Michael Keaton was part of that. One of the things I love is that he attributes the beginning of his career to WQED. I mean, it is a thrill for any Pittsburgher, and particularly anyone associated with WQED, to see him go up and accept a major international award and talk about getting his start at WQED in Pittsburgh. So we're so excited about this March 6th program that he's going to do, because it really does feel like he's our neighbor, too.
And that's just one of a number of things that are happening big this year. There's actually a feature film coming up about Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks. Now, I have to admit that Tom Hanks is a great choice, by the way. But you wonder how that will be handled. I mean, have you, the two of you, had any insight as to how this film will be handled?
Well, it's based on a relationship that was developed between Fred and interviewer. The influence that Fred had on that person when they worked together, and I think that ultimately what it speaks to is the influence that Fred had in real relationships with the people that he knew, beyond just the television relationship that he had with people. Time and time and time again, I hear stories from people who say that a single interaction with Fred in a chance encounter was life-changing for them. He had a way of simplifying an issue that somebody might have, or recognizing a problem that somebody might be wrestling with, and helping them in a very simple, kind phrase that stuck with them. And I think that's basically going to be the essence of that film, is seeing so many of those stories encapsulated into a single relationship. So we're excited about that.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. An interesting conversation we had came last October when the Smart Talk road trip took the show to Bethany Village in Mechanicsburg. We spoke with four Bethany Village residents about aging and getting older.
Ms. Toth, you're 75 years old.
Yes, I am.
You're married. You've been a resident here at Bethany Village since last year. Actually, it's been about a year and a half now.
That's correct.
So, at age 75, are you at a place in your life where you thought you would be?
Actually, I'm in a better place than I thought I would be. I love retirement. Aging and retirement have given me freedom to spend more time with my family, friends, travel, mostly more time to spend with my husband because I worked many hours in my career. And his decision to move to Bethany was a wonderful one. I love Bethany. I'm meeting new friends, doing new things, exploring new things, being involved with a lot more than I was before where we lived in the community. And I really love being part of the Bethany family.
But as you were, I was about to say growing up, but that makes it sound like.
Well, that's good because I'm still young, you know, in my head.
And that's good.
My body may be old, but my mind is still young.
Do you think of yourself as old?
No, I don't. Now, some mornings I creak and I, you know, my body doesn't do what I want it to do and I don't have enough energy. But in my mind, I am still in my 30s.
And what's, when you say that, you're still in your 30s, what do you mean by that?
I had a good time.
Yeah, in your 30s.
Yeah. But I can still think about all the things I did before. I still want to do all the things. I think that's a misconception about aging. The younger people think when you're old, you're stodgy. And that's not true. Mm-hmm. There are many people here who are doing wonderful things, creative things.
Marlon Snyder, let me turn to you. I'll ask the same question. Is being, and you're age 74, you've been at Bethany Village since 2008. Are you at a place in your life where you thought it would be? Is it what you pictured when you were growing older?
Prior to retirement, as growing older, I didn't think about it a lot, where I'd be at this point. I'm grateful at the position of life. In my profession and my calling, it was so focused on...
You're a retired minister.
Yeah, focused on others and serving others that just was the norm. And so in retirement, it's a whole new way of life and a wonderful season of opportunities. The day I retired, I kid you not, it was like the next morning, the weight was gone, like off your shoulders. Not that it was bad, but it was unencumbered. And so for me, the years here have been ones of choice that I like to, things I want to do and like to do, very fulfilling. I'm like Nancy, I don't feel old at all. Even though I spent many years in ministry, I have never been able, to be honest, never able to say, yeah, I'm going to die too. You know, I don't focus that way. I'm like her, that boy, some things ache. Some things are tight, and you deal with that. But overall, the retirement years for me have not been about the ending. Yeah. It's about living fulfilling life.
You said that when you were working that you really didn't think about retirement. I get the sense that there are many, many people who are in the same boat, that they don't think about retirement. You had to at one point. What did you think retirement would be like, and how is it different than how you pictured it?
I think the most that I thought about retirement, my wife Brenda and I thought about, was preparing financially, preparing for that type of thing, resources and those type of needs. When we came to Bethany, we were assuming, we were anticipating a place to live independently, hopefully for several years. And it was exactly like that, a place. But what I've discovered is a great sense of community that supports you within the borders or boundaries of Bethany Village, so to speak, but out into the world too.
See, you are in a position, or you were in a position in your profession as a minister, where you have met many people from many different walks of life. One of the things that we hear most often about getting older is that sense of community, or at least socializing, being around people. In your past, when you were a minister, did you come across people who were lonely, who really could have used that socialization as they got older?
Definitely. And for some of those people, they had the opportunities within their community of faith still to have that. It was more challenging for them, but very lonely. And I think that's one of the things you discover as you age, that I'm discovering is, and I'm an introvert. So what I'm discovering is you keep trying to get yourself involved or be among groups for that socialization piece that's important to stimulate you, to keep you healthy, not only mentally, but overall. So I think there are a lot of people out there who struggle. And one of the gifts here, again, has provided that. Mm-hmm.
Marianne Moorfield, you also were a person of the cloth as a chaplain at Dickinson College. You were around a lot of young people, I assume, as being the chaplain at Dickinson College. But let me ask you, you are 80 years old. You've been here since 2011. You are widowed. I'm sorry to hear about your loss of your husband. But I'll ask that same question. Is this what you pictured? And when I say this, meaning where you are in your life, not necessarily physically in Bethany Village, but the place in your life, what you pictured, how's it different? How's it the same?
Well, I think the place makes a difference. I never expected to live in a continuing care community. We lived on a farm, and we thought we'd always live there. So I have mourned leaving the farm. We came here when my husband was sick, and I realized I couldn't care for him at home. So we moved here, and it was really a blessing because he didn't want to move. I didn't want to move, but we found it was the right place to be. He got the care that he needed. We were able to stay in our house. Here, we live in a house, and so it was perfect. We have brought many of our friends here, which has been great, and then we've made new friends, which has been a wonderful thing. So I didn't picture it. Unlike Marlon, I knew while I was in ministry that, of course, I was going to die. Even as a chaplain at Dickinson, where mostly I worked with young people, I also worked with the faculty, and I did have quite a few funerals at the college, so that knowing I was going to die was not off my radar.
When you work with so many young people at Dickinson, what do you wish that young people would know about getting older?
I never thought about that. I was much younger then, and I didn't think about getting older either.
When did you first think about it?
I really, not until my husband began to be ill, did I think about that we were getting older.
And I have a sense, again, that that's when many people start thinking that, oh, I am starting to get older, is when those first physical signs of old age show themselves.
Right.
You consider yourself old?
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
See, I am glad this group makes me optimistic. Why do you say that?
Well, I don't feel old. I'm healthy. I just took on a new job of a little puppy, and people look at me and think I'm crazy, but I'm having a lot of fun.
What kind of dog?
I have a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel.
Oh, And a puppy.
A little puppy. So I take walks every day. I see lots of my friends. My dog is making friends with his little dog friends.
Is he housebroken?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Well,
oh, that's good.
Well, I've been training him. He wasn't housebroken when I bought him.
So. Have to ask all those important questions. No. Tony Wright, Tony, you're 71, retired purchasing agent.
Yes.
You've been here at Bethany Village since 2016. Mm-hmm. Yep. Everyone has talked about how the age they feel, and I'm not going to put a number on it, but do you feel old?
No, I do not.
You do not?
I've gotten younger since I've been here.
Why do you say that?
Because I'm doing a lot more things than I would have done if I had been home by myself, in my own home originally. Like Mary Ann, we moved here. My wife was ill most of the time, and we moved here with the thoughts that she could go for continuing care. And obviously that didn't last very long, but somebody asked me, so why did I stay here? Well, where was I gonna go, for one thing? Didn't have a house, I sold it. And when you look out here and you see, these are all my brothers and sisters that I didn't have 2 years ago. They're just a wonderful place to be, and they can tell you I'm involved in a lot of things that I wouldn't have been involved otherwise.
More now than you were when you were working?
Yes, oh yeah, when I was working, I didn't have time. Yeah. And I had a lot of stress when I was working, too. So,
you're not stressed now?
No, not at all. I'm stressed about how I can fit things into my schedule.
But that's a kind of a good stress
to
have.
Good stress, yes, it is. Yeah.
I'm curious, and this is, I have to admit that this is something that I deal with hosting a talk show every day. And that is how you want to be referred to. I mean, I hear people say seniors, elderly, or used to be senior citizens, older people. What do you want to be called? Go ahead, Mark.
I don't want to be called sweetie.
Or honey.
Oh, you said honey? You did that too?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? You think that that's like a sign of someone calling you that because of your age?
Yeah. I think we,
I won't call you sweetie, by the way. I guarantee.
But, as you're born into this life, and as you do die, and I do know I'm going to die, it's just up here sometimes I can't get there. We all have a name and a personhood, and sometimes in society we seem to label, and that takes away from whom we are. Like, I'm Marlon. Even as when I was in ministry, I wanted to be called Marlon, at best pastor, but nothing else. But Marlon, that's who I am. And in all stages of life, we have these needs, whether they're physical, spiritual, vocational, whatever. And that continues, and I think that's what's most important, at least for me, that you keep involved in these different aspects of life, and labeling is not helpful.
But sometimes we have to, when we talk about millennials, the baby boomers.
Yeah.
So what is good, what's not? Referring to your age group.
Mature.
Yeah. Mature. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A mature group. You're within a mature group.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when you hear the Pennsylvania Lottery commercials that say older Pennsylvanians, you'd rather that it benefited mature Pennsylvanians. Mm-hmm. Of course, that could be read another way. We have a lot of immature people who are 80 years old. Go ahead.
I don't mind older, but the sweetie, the honey thing is really bad.
You hear it a lot?
Yeah. Oh, we do. We do. It's like they try to put you as a little child, and it's very common. The grocery stores.
Waitresses.
Waitresses, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not nice.
Do you ever tell anyone that I'd rather not be known as honey or sweetie?
My husband and I laugh. He doesn't mind, but I,
yeah.
I'm offended.
Okay, the four of you have talked about being happy in the stage of life in which you are now. What don't you like about getting older? Tony?
I really don't. There's nothing I really don't like because it's having a good life, but don't like the connotation that we are old. I don't like that because we're not. We're young older people or something. But there's not too many things I don't like right now. You know?
I can't think of anything.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's hard. I think it's hard when we see our friends getting sick.
Yes.
I think that's very difficult to see them deteriorating. So that to me is the most difficult part.
Marlon?
I think for me the words loss, the losses, wherever we are, you know, as we age, we lose family. And I used to look at those at the head of the line as far as the age, and now I'm finding myself at the head of the line, having lost all these people important to me, you know, in life. Or talking about getting up and hurting, you know, you do lose things about your body. And there is some hints, there are hints that maybe you're not remembering everything like you did at one time. Those kind of things.
How do you stay happy then? If, I mean, you have to get sad, maybe even depressed when you think about the losses, you think about those memories, you think that, you know, death is something that you'll have to deal with. Mm-hmm. How do you maintain a good attitude?
I think it's your perspective of life. This is life. This is the way it is. And what's helpful is, again, to have some kind of support of your needs, you know, as you deal with these losses, whether you're living, aging at home or here or wherever that is, that the emotional, the spiritual, the social, all those things somehow are still provided for you to deal with, you know, these losses. My wife and I, you know, you laugh every day. You laugh with and at kind of each other. You know, you enjoy life. Or again, for me, it's been this perspective of something greater than me. It's not about me.
One of the things that, I don't know, just a personal point of view, and maybe it's because I was very close with my grandparents, is that an observation that we as a society, that you reach a certain age, whether it's retirement or even younger than that, we reach a certain age and we want to put you out the pasture. Oh yeah, go sit in your rocking chair. We don't want to hear from you anymore. And that kind of goes back to what you were talking about, being treated like a child. But one of the things I think that we as a society could do better is tap the experiences that you have in your lives. Nancy, let me ask you. You're a retired nurse.
Yes.
What experiences, and it doesn't have to be connected with your job, but what experiences do you think that you have had that you could impart to young people, maybe teach them, or younger people, that maybe they could learn a lesson?
Mentor them. I think that starting even with my own family, my grandchildren, and I think sometimes my grandson the other day, I was there to help him get ready for school, and he wouldn't let me do anything. He says, "You just sit in a chair." And I said, "Do you think I can't make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich?"
Yeah, really.
And he said, "But it's okay. You just sit right there." And I think humor, getting out and doing things with them. I can't play soccer anymore. I've had knee replacements, but I can get out there and watch the soccer game and yell.
You could play goalie.
Well, I could, yeah. But I wasn't very good to begin with. And I think some of the other things, telling them about my career, telling them what I did, being an example. Here I have plenty of experience navigating for some of my friends. I call myself the free Uber lady. Sometimes take people to the doctor and help them out. So for young people today, there's a lot of stress. There's a lot of stress in high school, and just telling them that some of the high school kids that don't think of just today. Think about your future and don't get bogged down with some of the stresses that you're doing. There's a lot of anxiety of young people out there today.
What about the rest of you? What experiences would you like to impart on younger people? What should they know?
How to have fun.
Mm-hmm. I think to kind of focus on a simpler life or simplicity. You know, enjoy, but don't feel you have to have so much.
You're talking about material things?
Material things or just titles, whatever it is, you know. And the other thing is gratitude. Be grateful people. Mm-hmm. Be grateful. That's going to take you a long way.
Were you grateful growing up?
I believe I was.
So that's an experience that you'd like younger people to learn.
Yeah, to be grateful, to be open to listening.
Marianne, what about you?
I wanted to speak to Marlon's issue of gratefulness because I found out after John died, everybody would said, well, aren't you so sad? And I said, yes, I'm sad, but I said, I am so grateful for having 54 years with him. So gratitude, I think, is such an important thing, and I found it so helpful. And I think I really learned that through his death, just learning how important that was.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Last July, the road trip took Smart Talk to the George Spangler Farm in Gettysburg. The Spangler Farm served as a hospital after the 1863 battle, but our conversation focused on peace and civility on the 75th anniversary of the dedication of the Eternal Peace Light at Gettysburg.
I want to go back to 1938, Matthew Mullen, when President Roosevelt dedicated the Eternal Peace Light Memorial on the Gettysburg battlefield. And some of the words that I'm going to read that I want everyone to think about as we talk about the atmosphere that we have in this country today. It says on the monument, an enduring light to guide us in unity and fellowship. That's on the monument. President Roosevelt said, sometimes the threat to popular government comes from political interest, sometimes from economic interest. Sometimes we have to beat all of them off together. But the challenge is always the same, whether each generation facing its own circumstances can summon the practical devotion to attain and to retain that greatest good for the greatest number, which this government of the people was created to ensure. Those words, I read those words because I think about the state of our country today, and we do have a lot of division out there. Many people probably should be thinking about this, but I don't know. I find the irony on a Civil War battlefield, the bloodiest battle fought on the North American continent, that words about peace and civility ring so true even today.
So Gettysburg in 1863 was the major battle, really, in the history of North America. And that signature storyline is what we do here at Gettysburg with our partners, the National Park Service, which is responsible for telling that story. But for 155 years, Gettysburg has not been a place of conflict. It has been a place of veteran reunions, presidential speeches, an Eternal Peace Light Memorial, conciliatory remarks, care of the wounded like here at Spangler, the citizens of Gettysburg turning out to care for wounded of both sides. And so it's a magnificent place to talk historically, but it's also a magnificent place to talk about American public life today because it's a place of conflict and conciliation both.
Talk about how the country was divided in 18, leading up to Fort Sumter in 1861.
A civil war is animated really by two principal causes, right? One is slavery and one is states' rights. And that leads to this monumental conflict, which is one that costs 600,000 American lives, right? Today's situation, we're really talking about a more civil public dialogue and the restoration of a more civil public dialogue among us. It doesn't mean setting aside our differences. We're going to have many differences that arise naturally out of a large, diverse, complicated country. but is respectfully addressing those within the framework of a constitutional republic that includes separation of powers, a Bill of Rights, fragmentation of political power because our framers trusted no one with too much political authority. And so it's that conversation that we as Americans are certainly capable of having and certainly capable of resolving. We've overcome many challenges in the history of this country. This is one that is now upon us, but as you say, Scott, it may not be our most challenging moment. It is one we simply have to start paying attention to as Americans.
As a historian, when you hear someone say that today we are more divided than ever before, first of all, I'd have to think that one of the thoughts that goes through your mind is know your history a little bit more and what we can learn from that history. But what do you think?
Well, I'm a political scientist by training and used to teach American political thought. And when you go back and read debates around the events leading up to the Civil War, you read about the different points of view that fed into the conflict. There's obviously been deep division. There is caricature of politicians by other politicians. What seems to be substantially different this time around is that everyone through social media can be a player. And so that's, I think, one of the things that we as a democracy need to figure out is how do you make a deliberately slow decision-making process, an incremental decision-making process in a constitutional republic work in an instantaneous age?
Just think if Lincoln and Jefferson Davis had Facebook. Who knows how long that would have gone on? But I want to talk to Dr. Gene Pretz, who is a professor and chair of the psychology department at Elizabethtown College. Dr. Pretz, you know, Dr. Moen used, you know, he was talking about American political thought. So let's talk about thinking. How did we get to this point? From a psychological point of view, how did we get to this point where Americans are so divided? And I mean, we've always had different opinions. I mean, our system of government is an adversarial form of government, but today adversarial seems to take on harsher tones.
So the nature of human cognition is that we tend to look for groups of people. We see people as a group. We see what they have in common, which then means that we tend to divide people. We see like, oh, we have this in common, and those people are different from us. And that's the nature of how we are. We find categories in the world. And that can be very adaptive, especially when you're young and you're trying to figure out, is this safe to eat? Is this not safe to eat? But when it comes to like social categories, we also are victim to like an automatic way of processing the world that leads us not to notice commonalities we might have with people who are not members of our group. We have two different ways of thinking, an automatic, intuitive way of thinking versus an analytical, deliberative way of thinking. And when we operate according to this default automatic system, we tend to stereotype people, put people into groups, and really not pay attention to how we could overcome those differences. It takes more work to engage analytical thinking, to be deliberative, to be a critical thinker. And as a college professor, that's what I'm trying to help my students do, but it's hard work.
But that's not different. I mean, the things that you just described, that has been from the beginning of time how human beings have, you know, they've grouped together where they feel safe. What's different today in that thinking?
Well, I definitely think social media is playing into that. When we are having conversations online, we tend to be communicating with people who are our friends, people who we already have identified as having something in common with. We might not have to have that face-to-face interaction. I might feel less comfortable confronting a person directly, whereas it's easier to do so online. Also, we might not even recognize how much we are being selectively exposed to information, only information coming from our viewpoint. Even when you Google information, my results might look different from your results based on my search history, based on my demographic characteristics that Google knows about me. So even though I think I'm getting unbiased information, that might not be the case. So we have to really engage critical thinking and be deliberative and seek alternate perspectives.
Thank you for listening to this Top Stories of 2018 on Smart Talk episode. I'm Scott Lamar.